Mrs. Bagthorpe now, however, timidly put in her own oar. "I think, Lucy dear, that Wong Fu will be much happier in proper kennels," she said diplomatically. "Pekingese are such delicate creatures, and need much sensitive handling." "Which will not be forthcoming at our place," Mr. Bagthorpe supplied, unnecessarily. "If it stopped there, it'd probably have a nervous breakdown. I certainly should. It will go to the kennels, and you, Lucy, will foot the bill." Aunt Lucy was not going to give in this easily, and was about to embark on a thoroughgoing row, when a diversion occurred in the shape of an elderly lady at the far end of the ward, rising from her pillows, waving her arms wildly, and screaming for a nurse. "Take her away!" she screeched, meaning, apparently, Daisy. "I won't listen, I won't!" She covered her ears with her hands, and a contingent of nurses moved rapidly down to her end of the ward. "What is the matter?" they asked. "What has she done?" What Daisy had been doing soon became clear. Abandoning with disappointment her fruitless search for skeletons and corpses, she had turned her attention to the patients themselves. Some of them, she thought hopefully, might become corpses quite soon, and she could put in an offer for the undertaking. She had therefore been systematically working down the row of beds, making a critical appraisal of the life expectancy of their occupants. She was to some extent handicapped in this by being unable to see the length of their lower limbs, and was accordingly asking each lady, "Is your legs long or short?" before making her diagnosis. The ladies in the ward had been held in a state of hypnotized fascination until one of their number had started screaming. The sort of things Daisy was saying no one present, and many of them were mothers and grandmothers, had ever heard from the lips of one so young. And they had no idea, of course, of her background, or that she was currently in a phase of intimations of mortality. She was saying things like, "Oh, look at your hair. It's all gray. And you've got a lot of wrinkles as well, especially on your neck. I think you might die quite soon, really soon. Is your legs long or short?" She made her speculations in so matter-of-fact a way that her subjects actually felt that she might know something about the matter, and those among them with gray hair and wrinkles were quite frightened. When Daisy's part in the screaming episode was established, she in turn became extremely unhappy and sobbed bitterly. Aunt Celia was not there to protect her, and Mr. Bagthorpe, abandoning his row with Great Aunt Lucy, pitched into her on a scale never before known. Jack found himself feeling sorry for her. He did not pretend to understand the way Daisy's mind worked. He thought it possible that nobody ever would understand this, but he felt certain that however cataclysmic the effect she so often had on those about her, this was quite unintentional. Daisy did not really have any vice in her. It was just that she liked experimenting, with fire and water, for instance, and that she became bored when she was not occupied. Jack had been impressed by the way Daisy had been shedding real tears over her recent victims, including the chops. He thought this showed an essential softness of heart for which people were not apt to give her credit, with the exception of Rosie, who herself deputized for Aunt Celia by attacking Mr. Bagthorpe. "You're a nasty grook, just like Daisy says," she shrieked at him. "You don't care tuppence when things die and get buried. Daisy's really sweet the way she sobs and cries and has funerals and writes on their tombstones. If you don't look out, I shan't cry when you're dead." All this bandying about of words like tombstone and funeral, and at a pitch more suited to a music hall than a hospital ward, was becoming too much. One of the younger nurses panicked and telephoned for the matron. She had heard that this august person was a battle-axe when roused, and thought that she, if anybody, would be able to quiet and evict the Bagthorpes. She was mistaken about this, because Mr. Bagthorpe knew nothing of hospital hierarchies, and did not at first even know that she was the matron. He thought she was a stout, elderly nurse in a different uniform from the rest. Even when he had been made to understand who she was, matters were improved for nobody but Daisy, from whom he immediately turned his attention to pitch into the matron instead. Mr. Bagthorpe detested bureaucracy and authority in any form, even at the best of times, and of course believed that he was in his present plights as a direct result of the activities of these nebulous enemies. So far he had not confronted anybody, even his bank manager, about this, and the luckless matron made a convenient whipping boy. "I would not at this moment be in the throes of a desperate fight for survival," he told this bewildered lady, "if it were not for the system. You are a part of the system. You do not run this hospital. I do. You, madam, are a servant of the state. I am forever paying out vast sums of money, left and right, in taxation, for the maintenance of this kind of benighted institution." Mr. Bagthorpe often did not know when he was mistiming his tirades. A ward full of semi-hysterical patients and frantic nurses do not wish for an exposition on taxation. They wish for order to be restored, for peace and quiet. The scene ended in a way that was less than dignified. The same resourceful nurse who had called the matron reassessed the situation and sent for two porters. Their burly and belligerent appearance caused Mr. Bagthorpe's tirade to trail off in mid-sentence. "I am leaving," he announced, "and I shall not be back. You, Lucy, should try to take advantage of the next few weeks to get your ideas sorted out. Put your house in order." He stamped out, followed by the rest of the Bagthorpes and all eyes in the ward. Most of the patients were left feeling distinctly limp after this visit, and Mrs. Fosdyke later received a first-hand account of it from one of her cronies, Mrs. Pye, who was in there to have some ingrowing toenails removed. She had been one of the luckless ladies with gray hair and wrinkles, and Daisy had firmly placed her in the category of being in early need of burial. Mrs. Pye was much upset by this, despite repeated assurances from the nurses that people do not die of ingrowing toenails. "Them Bagthorpes you work for certainly is a bunch of lunatics," she told Mrs. Fosdyke after her discharge. "Them nurses was dishing out tranquilizers like sweets. You never in your life could imagine the racketing they set up in that ward." Mrs. Fosdyke denied this. She could imagine it, she said, clearly. Only that day Mrs. Fosdyke had received further indications of the seriousness of the plan for survival, and was considering, not for the first time, giving her notice. "You never heard such mad twaddle in your life," she told Mrs. Pye. "That beautiful summer house. There's all the deck chairs and parasol stuck in my storeroom, and wire netting all over everywhere, and the food they're eating you'd never believe. It's all right for them that's been bankrupted and got to survive, but what about them that hasn't?" Her own health, she maintained, was probably being damaged. She took a large number of her meals at Unicorn House, by all the lettuce and rhubarb and beetroot. She had a cousin, Kitty, who had died of an overdose of vitamins, she said, and she had no wish to go the same way herself. I yelled back.